Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I welcome you to another week of discussion regarding the world of technology and law without necessarily having to be a lawyer or a techie to understand what's going on. You're listening to KZSU Stanford University, and I am pleased today to have on as a guest the author of the book Who Controls the Internet out of Oxford Press, Tim Wu. Tim is a professor at Columbia Law School as well as a frequent contributor to Slate Magazine, and I am very pleased today to have him here to discuss his new work co-authored with Jack Goldsmith, who is not a guest today. Tim will be on today. The topic of the book, or the subtitle of the book, is Illusions of a Borderless World. And it really touches on, and the book really explains in an incredibly detailed and readable manner, the confusion or misperceptions of how the internet operates. I'm going to get into a lot of those details with Tim as we explore what he means by both the title and the subtitle. But it's an interesting issue because it really kind of tells us a little bit about how we view the technology that is all around us and how we perceive its operation. It certainly was the case going back into the early 90s and mid-90s, when I started becoming familiar with the internet, that people generally called it the information superhighway, some kind of unregulatable space where governments were obsolete, where rules were obsolete, where even standards to some degree were obsolete, and where people were going to have uninhibited freedom to do whatever they wished. And while the internet may at one point or another have had elements of that, and may very well still, the misperception that Tim identifies in this book is really a core issue. And the core issue boils down to that the internet is regulatable, that the internet is subject to rules and laws, and that whether it's governments or nonprofit organizations or individuals who are involved in technology, any one of those groups or all of those groups may, in fact, attempt and will exert influence on the internet. So the issue becomes who controls it. And this is a very topical issue right now, as the United States has historically been the entity and government and people who control the internet. But more and more, as the internet becomes a worldwide avenue of sharing information and commerce and what have you, various governments and groups of people want to have more and more say. And Tim's book points out fascinatingly how the percentage of English language websites steadily decreases on the internet. But we're going to go into all of these issues and really kind of explore what this book is about, really was the impetus behind its writing, why the book is necessary, and really where we are today, and hopefully also touch on where we're headed. So I'm very pleased to have Tim on today to discuss this terrific book, and I've read it and really enjoyed it, and I recommend it to, especially to the listeners of this show, because my show, as you know, if you've been listening to it, is really aimed at people who are not necessarily well-versed in these issues and who are trying to learn more. And I can say truly that having read Tim's book, that it's and Jack Goldsmith's book, I'll refer to it as Tim's book for the remainder of the show, because he's the guest, but it, like I said, it is co-authored with Jack Goldsmith. But the book really is incredibly readable and really a lot of fun to read, because they get into many of the interesting characters that were involved in the founding and creation of the internet and its antecedents, and also some of the players today. So when we return from a short music break, I will bring Tim on the air. So if I've done my job properly, Tim, are you there?
I'm here, and a nice choice of music.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I try to pick some interesting stuff, and I'm pleased that you heard it and enjoyed it. Thank you for being here today, Tim.
Sure.
Who is joining us by telephone, and the show is being recorded on August 25th, for those of you who are keeping track. Tim, why don't we start right off and kind of talk a little bit about the impetus behind authoring Who Controls the Internet?
Well, you know, there's a lot of reasons I wrote the book, or we wrote the book. I think that there were just a lot of things we wanted to say. There's this long history, this 10 years by the time the book came out, of interactions between governments and the internet, and a lot of confusion. There was, you know, Grokster, there was Napster, there was China, there was just a lot going on, and we were just trying to sort of make head or tails of what had happened over the last 10 years. In that sense, the book is a kind of a history. A second reason is I think I'm personally, you know, lived a lot of this stuff, and I have a certain fascination with the kind of utopianism of the early internet and of any kind of utopian and vision, and I'm very interested in seeing what those ideas really were and why exactly they didn't work out. So I guess those are two of the reasons.
Let's talk a little bit about the latter reason, the utopianism, because that is a fascinating area, and it's something that you really develop nicely in the book. It really seems, from reading your book and from general information, that there was a almost euphoria about what the internet might be when it really exploded into the public consciousness. Why don't we talk a little bit about that? What's your sense of those antecedents?
Well, I think it's an interesting era because, you know, obviously the internet was transformative, was revolutionary. You know, you could email people in email itself. Suddenly you could, mail somebody a message, and that used to take several days by post, and suddenly it just took a couple seconds. So there was this revolution, and it made people feel that not only would, you know, certain things like mail be changing, but everything would be changing, especially things like government, that some of the sort of ways we've been governing ourselves with presidents and congresses had suddenly become out of date. And I think a lot of people, sort of their visions of what the world should be like became projected onto this network. It's kind of a familiar trend. It's sort of the way when the West opened up in the United States, people saw the West as just this kind of screen for their visions of an ideal society. And so people took the internet and some of its changes and projected onto it the origins of an ideal society. And I just find that particularly fascinating chapter.
It's having studied Mumford and other utopian theorists when I was in college, it definitely seems like what Mumford and others wrote about, this idea of the egalitarian society where people were moving freely, where there was not a need to earn money, make money, worry about sustenance, things like that. It seems to color some of the early characters who created the internet. And one of the interesting people that you mentioned in your book that I kind of, since we're going in that direction now, that I just wanted to talk about initially, is John Postel. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about him? Because I think he kind of, from how you described him, the late John Postel, seemed to really merge the technological nature and need of the internet in terms of how it operated with these larger ideas that were vested in the operation of the early internet.
Well, you know, for listeners who don't know, for some people the name John Postel is like the name George Washington. They just know what it means immediately. But for listeners who aren't familiar, John Postel was the original administrator of the Internet's naming system and also one of the early Internet researchers who did so much to invent the Internet and make it happen. Postel himself invented email, for example, the simple email transfer protocol. So he was this exciting figure. But Postel's significance and the relevance to our conversation is people look to him as a kind of governing authority. And he fit the part. He had a long beard. He had kind of a wise and thoughtful nature. He tried to always do what was best for the network. And indeed, he had an enormous amount of power over the early network in various ways. And so he was sort of the governance idea of a kind of wise guru who understood and did what was best and could be trusted to administer the internet. And so people looked to him. There's an early article in 1995 in Wired talking about the internet engineers as this sort of ideal form of governance. But people looked to people like Postel, this sort of wise god of the internet, as a model for how human affairs should be run. And, you know, I think that was a very exciting vision.
You go through in your book and in really setting up where we are now, like I said, I think in a terrific way. You talk about his challenges and the challenges that he brought to the intrusion, perhaps, of governments and governing entities on the operation of the internet. And you describe the conflict and the interactions that he had with Ira Magaziner when he was with in the Clinton administration and the internet czar. How did those interactions, in your opinion, if you could describe them briefly, again, for listeners who aren't familiar, that would be great. But how do you think those interactions brought us to where we are today, which we'll talk about shortly?
Sure. Well, let me. I think I have to give a little bit more to the idea of what Postel was about. So there's the Internet Naming System, worldwideweb.stanford.edu, and someone has to decide who gets that name. And for quite a long time, there was just one guy, basically, you know, on his beach. He was a professor at USC, and he would walk around, kind of this academic hermit, and you know, almost like Gandalf or something. And if you wanted, you know, if you wanted the Stanford.edu, you would ask him, and if it was right, he'd give it to you, and if you weren't Stanford, he wouldn't give it to you. So he just kind of ruled by fiat, but he was wise, and so everybody trusted him. I mean, it sounds like a fairy tale, but it's actually true. And, you know, you have that guy, and so that guy, originally you're talking about something that's worth nothing, and then we talk about, we move the 90s, suddenly these domain names are worth millions, collectively billions of dollars. And so you have a guy on a beach who's in control of an asset worth billions of dollars, which can, if abused or treated wrongly, upset the internet economy and possibly the world economy. So there's this period in the 90s, which you're talking about, where the Clinton administration, a man named headed in this area by a man named Ira Magaziner, became interested in and wanted to make sure that this system, which was becoming so much more important to the nation's economy, was really being run in a stable way. And so there developed this quiet and sort of slow battle between basically the United States government and the internet gurus and some of their allies over who would finally control the ultimate authority over naming on the internet, which is also sort of the only centralized authority on the internet. And, you know, their interactions were interesting. Ira, he's an interesting guy. You know, he himself is an interesting guy, and he felt strongly that John Postel, he had a lot of respect. He said things like, I love John Postel, and I saw him as this visionary figure, but in some sense, there's a sense that his time had passed. Mm-hmm. You couldn't continue to have this entire internet run by a guy on a beach. And so there's this funny feeling of just, you know, you respect this guy, but in some ways it's time to hand over the torch. Unfortunately, things don't go completely wrong. I don't know if you want to. I can go on.
I think it's a fascinating story, yeah. And it kind of I think points out to listeners and to anyone just how almost serendipitous the forming of the internet was.
Right. I mean, serendipitous, but I have enormous respect for these early framers as well. They had this vision of a network that really embodied certain virtues and values which were important. It's a tolerant network. They're like the framers of the Constitution. They put some values into this internet, which are still with us. We still fight over them, like the network neutrality, and they're ingenious. It just wasn't clear whether these were the right people to still be running this thing day to day. You see, it's one of these situations where you have a revolution, and are the revolutionaries the right administrators? That's kind of the question. And, you know, things could have been more peaceful, but, you know, there really were egos at stake, and things got a little tense. And in this famous moment in January 1998, highly disputed in internet history, but I'll say a bit about
sure.
it. There's this time when John Postel, our hermit on the beach, I don't want to take all the details, but basically took back the authority of the internet and transferred most of the naming authority back to his personal computer. So he had for a while taken about half of the, actually two-thirds of the internet naming authority and put it on his personal computer back at USC and said, you know, he is now the central computer. And so the internet was split for days between the United States controlled parts and the John Postel controlled parts, you can imagine.
And for people who aren't familiar, we're talking about the entire internet. It's not just a portion of it.
No.
This was anyone who was connecting to it at that time.
Right. Was either going through when they were, you know, the ultimate authority over what was going to be the names. I mean, there's technical details which I
right.
don't want to get into. But
right.
you know, there's basically either there was kind of two internets almost. One headed by the United States government and one headed by John Postel. It only lasted for a few days.
Right.
And nothing went seriously wrong. However, you know, the United States government reacted and finally flexed their muscles and said, And we have, in the book, we actually have a transcript, well, from, unfortunately, John Postel has passed away, but Ira told us in an interview what went through this famous moment when they confronted each other over the telephone. Ira was in Switzerland, Postel was in California, and he warned him that you are going to get in serious trouble if you continue doing this. Later on, they announced anyone who tried to do anything like that, again, would be prosecuted criminally. So at some stage, and this is a big theme in the book, at some stage it all came down to this physical force and this power to threaten to arrest people, which is really part of what our book is about. You would think in the virtual world that geography doesn't matter, this doesn't matter, but amazingly and surprisingly, the fist, you know, the power to arrest people still has this power. I don't want to know if it's fundamental, but it still has this residual relevance because we still have these physical bodies. Anyway,
well, at least
going on and on. Yeah.
No. I think it's fascinating stuff, and my my silence is because I'm listening as intently as I hope other people are. But it does move me in the direction, the larger direction of just in a nutshell, who controls the internet? Is the title of your book. And control is a very interesting word, and I imagine a carefully chosen one. Tell us a little bit about why you chose that title for the book.
You may overestimate us. We also
perhaps
have a marketing department. you know, why do we choose the word control? Because I think that's the question people want to know the answer to. I think that's a good question. I mean, no one. It's a funny question. Like, how is you don't know what the answer is to that question? You know, who controls? And I think that's the question I thought was just, you know, it's kind of an obvious question, but no one really knows the answer. And the answer in our book is that, you know, it's kind of a, I don't think we unfortunately give 100, you know, it's funny, it's a title, we should give a clear answer, but the trend that we say is that obviously countries are having a much greater role in controlling this thing. In other words, law and the old traditional sovereigns have exercised a much greater role in determining in the end what the internet is than they ever did in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the story. So the who controls the internet is not completely answered just like that, but the trend is definitely for governments to take it over.
Right.
Well, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no. I want to kind of quote one sentence from the book, and I always, whenever I start quoting a book, I point out that I am quoting one sentence. And that, of course, there's a larger context in the book, which
I thought you were going to ask for copyright permission.
And now I was going to say, and then that would be my next step, the clear rights. But the quote kind of, I think, is just a great sentence, and I kind of want to build on it. But in the chapter, which is appropriately titled "Conclusion: Vices, Virtues, and the Future," you say, "What's missing is the power of places, nations, and regions to protect the way they are or want to be." And you build through the book various examples of where businesses and individuals have run into these either governmental values or cultural values in different areas of the internet and really face down this question of who's really calling the shots. But maybe on this relatively abstract sentence we could build, what do you mean by that fact of the power of places missing from the analysis?
Yeah, that's really you know, at a deeper level, criticism of the globalization debate that we're talking about there. You know, there's a sense when you read about the internet, you read about global commerce racing around the world, as if the places that they affect are these passive recipients who have no power to do anything about it or direct it. And I just don't think that's true. I just think that's, you know, it may feel that way sometimes, but I just don't think it's true. And what happens is if they have the power to make things the way they want it, they will. That is, if, you know, people want to protect the way they are, they will. And I think the whole history of the globe and the whole history, I think we'll see, of globalization is that sometimes more connectedness can even mean more difference. It may seem strange, but it may. You know, you look at the United States, a highly collected, you know, connected country, but, you know, the people who really want to be different are really different. And so I think our mistake is to think of the people in the world and places that want to be different as just these sort of passive entities who have no power to do anything about it. So that's what I meant by that.
Is the Internet, and this is more of an opinion question,
yeah,
but is the Internet a space which is more or less difficult to regulate than, say, a community. And I know, you know, just a normal town. And I know that that sounds like a somewhat obvious question, but I guess what I'm getting at is the issue of control. If you are on the internet, and this is maybe a technological question, I don't mind getting into that a little bit. But right. when you, the individual, are typing a search query into Google, or you're accessing your email through Yahoo, or you're researching the best vacation place, you at any moment could come across things that in a particular culture are offensive, in your locality might be illegal or dangerous to look at, and yet I think there's a perception that unless law enforcement, unless someone comes down on you, you're almost free to do what you want. In other words, there's an anonymity on the internet that I think people perceive as very real. And some recent changes and some recent events like the AT&T case, the sharing of phone records, or the surveillance issues or what have you, kind of shake that up. And the internet is, as you talk about in your book and as we chatted about here, has had the aura of being this unregulated, difficult space with which to figure out who's where and what's going on. But it seems like from your book that that's really an incorrect assumption about the internet, and that more and more control takes place. So the question really is, that lead up really leads to this question, is the internet that much different from a regulatory standpoint than the mayor of, you know, the village of Smithtown trying to make sure that kids are in, you know, not loitering on the street and people aren't shooting each other in their homes?
Yeah, and I think you're getting at a great, you know, something really great and important with this question. And I do think the internet, by its nature, by its original design, is hard to regulate, precisely because it was built to embody very libertarian ideals. I've talked a little bit about them before, but I do believe that in its original founding, whether intentionally or unintentionally, the American internet, invented mainly in California, it's kind of Californian. It's kind of hard to control. It's, you know, designed in the 70s, and it embodies a certain libertarianism in it that makes it intrinsically, by that nature, by its starting point, harder to control by its original design. The question, however, and the big question, is whether it's possible to change that original nature, mm-hmm. whether it's possible to design, you know, take the internet and make it into something that, by its default, much more controllable. And that is where you have to talk about the example of China, where China has been making the world's most extensive effort to try and change the very nature of the network to begin with, to make it feel not like something that is anonymous to begin with, but feel like something that is watched, to make it not like something that necessarily has everything in the world you might want, but has content that is approved by government. And, you know, they've gone pretty far in that effort. I just came back from China, and mm-hmm. it is a different type of experience there. It has some of the same features, but I do think people feel that when they do things on the internet, they, in a sense, are watched. They have a sense that, you know, they have a sense that you can do things, but there's some line out there, and you do too much, and you're going to get in trouble, because people do get in trouble. People get arrested, thrown in jail. Things happen to them. And then also, as you know, the internet, it's not perfect, but for the general user, it's a lot of stuff is filtered out at various levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that is the real question. And, you know, China's only been at this in 10 years, and I don't think the internet is changing China in other ways. But I think, and I say this in the book, that we look back at this 20 years, 30 years, I think we'll find that this is the question. Is the internet more powerful, or are these countries and their ideas and their cultural identities more powerful? I think it's a little of both. I think China will be different, but I think ultimately the Chinese internet will be 20 years down the line quite a bit different than what we have here in the United States.
There's as you know, there's a burgeoning focus on the concept of public diplomacy from an international standpoint, the idea that in order to win the hearts and minds, quote-unquote, you need to go directly to the cultural values of the individuals and attempt to attempt to touch them, attempt to connect with them at that level. And it's something that I think the entire debate going back to Nixon involving the engagement with China really is focused around. And having spent time in China, I would be remiss to not ask you, how did you feel as an individual using the internet in China? Now, obviously, you're extremely well versed in the issues, but I'm curious to know what just using the internet, how did you feel?
Well, you know, it's kind of a pain. It's a pain. It's not bad. I mean, it's there, and broadband is reasonably inexpensive, but it's a pain for a lot of reasons. When I first got there, the first week I got there, Google was blocked. Google.com was blocked out entirely, and Wikipedia is always blocked. So, you know, I didn't realize how much I kind of depend on Wikipedia for, I don't know, amusement and gossip and reading. And so there's one, you know, Wikipedia's gone. Google, you know, and you a week without Google, you realize that you're an addict. And the other problem is that other, you know, so a lot of the sites are gone. And then sites are, there's huge differences in sites and how fast they respond, depending on whether they're local sites and foreign sites. Now, some of that's to be expected, but China is particularly careful about having everything go through a couple checkpoints coming in and out of the country. And its bandwidth, the country, you know, the amount of internet speed inside the country is a lot more than outside the country. So basically, getting to outside sites is a pain. It's like dial-up. Well, domestic sites are quick and fast, and so your every incentive is to stay inside the country.
It's amazing, and I think that that's – I will take a short music break, but I want to come back to that because I think it gets back to the issue of control and the issue of who ultimately is directing what you can and cannot do with the technology. So let's take a short music break, and when we return, we'll continue discussion with Tim Wu, author of Who Controls the Internet. But before we get back to Tim, I wanted to point out that I hope you like what you're hearing today. And I want to ask that you help make sure that KZSU can continue providing great programs without commercials to listeners all over the Bay Area. I'm going to ask you directly to donate to KZSU. For more information, email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, a slightly different address than we've used previously, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And don't forget to keep on listening. So, Tim, we're back. And let's continue the discussion from where we left off with the issue of China. And you started off the book with discussing the Yahoo's initial experience and their transformation dealing with China. Why don't we get into a little of that? Maybe you could tell the listeners about that story.
Well, it's a great story. You know, Yahoo is a really interesting actor in the late 90s, early 2000s that sort of tells the story in themselves of how things have changed. Yahoo, in the 90s, you know, obviously came to fame and was very rich. They had the stock price of the 400s. And their first hint of legal trouble, the first sort of time they ran into law, was this auction case, very famous auction case, which your listeners may know. The French, a lawsuit in France accused Yahoo of trafficking in Nazi paraphernalia because on the Yahoo auction site, Yahoo is an auction site like eBay, you could buy Nazi stuff. And so they faced this lawsuit. They said this was a horrendous attack on free speech. It was wrong. It was everything the internet was supposed to not be, so on and so forth. And this was sort of the free speech battle, one of the free speech battles in the late 1990s, actually early 2000s. And then what Yahoo does is they're fighting this battle, and then slowly, this is about when the bubble starts to collapse, and they realize they need to do something with Google and all these other firms nipping at their heels. And so Yahoo moves to China, or they open their China office. And the story, I mean, the real hint of the drama here is while they're fighting this free speech cause in France, they're in China capitulating with the regime. They're telling the Chinese government that they will, you know, read emails, report, they will stop things, speech that is threatening to the state. They sign a sort of pact where they agree to for themselves monitor and report any kind of dangerous communications. Eventually, they end up doing two things. Yahoo. First thing is they capitulate in the France case, so they give up and they say, okay, we're not going to have any more Nazi materials. Their stock is about $8. Later on, they completely roll over, as I said, in China. Hmm. And in fact, it even gets to the point where Yahoo supplies emails to the Chinese government, allowing them to arrest the Chinese dissident, throw him in jail for 10 years. So there's a complete sort of heart of darkness situation where the champion of free speech becomes sort of an agent of thought control, all over the course of 5 years, and all in the course of a massive reversal in the stock market. So I thought Yahoo's doesn't look the best in our story.
Yeah, and you know, it seems like more and more, getting back to these initial ideals, that those ideals are going the way of the dodo. I wonder from researching this book.
Can I just say something about
that?
Oh,
sure, of course.
I think, you know, I mean, a lot of what the internet is like is going to depend on the backbone. Sorry. It's going to depend on the big companies that are the internet, Google, Yahoo, the big service providers, the people own. I mean, ultimately, the internet is not a cloud of its actual companies.
Right.
And what we learn from the book is that companies fear governments.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just what it comes down to, is companies are afraid, and big companies basically do what government tells them what to do. And so we saw Yahoo roll over. Now we've seen Google, of course, going to China. And so if your hopes for the freedom of the internet are pinned on the back of for-profit corporations, the predictable is going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a very fair point, and it kind of gets to another issue that you know, that your book talks about, which is the commercialization of the internet generally. Its original purpose, or its original incarnation was as a scientific network, effectively communicating between scientists and Defense Department and what have you. And obviously the events of the late 90s really changed what people saw the internet doing. I guess now I'm asking you to take out your crystal ball. And every time I ask people to take out their crystal ball, I point out that as a litigator, I always hated the crystal ball question. Are we going to win a case? Which was invariably the answer would be, well, it's tough to say, which was a true answer. But I'm going to ask you to use your crystal ball a little bit in the remaining time that we have left. Your book leads us really right up to today. Obviously, it's a new book. And I'm curious, with the events that have occurred just in the last, you know, 3 or 4 months, and the lawsuit that EFF brought regarding AT&T and what have you, where do you think we're headed on the issue of who controls the internet? Is there a potential for change? Is the mere fact that the public perhaps is more aware of some of these issues potentially an agent of calling into question who's calling the shots? What's your sense of that?
Right. So now we have to distinguish carefully between what I hope will happen and what is likely to happen.
Right. Yes.
See, you know, I mean, I love the internet. I grew up with it. I was back using email back in 1989. So I've always loved the internet, and really one of the book's points is to say you can't be naive about the idea that it's going to take care of itself. There is no question that over the next 5-10 years, we are going to see enormous pressures from very powerful actors, mostly governments and large carriers like AT&T and SBC and other countries. SBC doesn't exist. AT&T and Verizon to assert, to make the internet into what they want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're the best position actors, in a sense, to control what the internet becomes. And I think the battle will be between the power of governments and of carriers versus what people are willing to accept and to the degree to which they feel that they like the internet the way it is.
Just for the uninitiated, when you use the term carriers, how would you define that here?
Well, the carriers are the people who own the wires,
mm-hmm,
that are the internet, the fiber optic cables, and most probably critically the last mile, the connections between the internet proper and your home, the cable connections and the which are, you know, there's only two companies, there are only two types of companies really now who control that kind of connection, and they're the cable companies and the bell companies. So I know this is getting all a bit complicated, but I'm saying that what we are facing here, and actually why this issue of network neutrality has become so critical, is network neutrality is kind of an issue as to who controls the internet. The carriers have plans to make the internet a different way than it has been, using the power that they have, and the question is whether the public and the government thinks that that the internet should be the way it's been. So that I'm getting a little complicated, but that's basically where I think things are going.
No, and I think it's a complicated issue. I think actually you've done a pretty good job simplifying very complicated issues. But your book touching on that issue really identifies the three core values or the three core bases of the operation of the early internet as open, minimalist, and neutral.
Yes.
And those are all very, very, really quite revolutionary concepts when you consider the impact and the ability of the internet to allow people to communicate and share information and buy and sell and trade and really just connect. Open, minimalist, and neutral. Which or all or how many of those three values do you think are really under attack today?
They're all under attack, mm-hmm. I'd say. There's a deep philosophical difference as to what networks should be like, and the phone companies, cable companies, have always operated networks that are the opposite. They're closed networks, they're complex, and they're not neutral. I mean, the cable company carries the cable company's stuff. The phone company is kind of in the middle, but in general, they control the network, and they're in charge of what it's like. And so I'd say all of those things are under pressure. I won't say it's completely collapsing, but they're under pressure. And I want to emphasize, those three principles have been, they sound quite lofty, but they've been very important to not only the cultural development, but the economic development of this country.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about those principles is if you have something that's open, that's minimal, that's neutral, it can be a platform for people to do other stuff. And that has been the real, the real insight, the real genius of the Internet. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier. One
Sure.
of the things I hated about using the Internet in China is it's obviously biased in favor of certain sites over another. And it really is a pain. When a site takes forever to load, you just don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of thinking, like, this is the future. There's sites that are really a pain to load versus the ones that load like that. They have a huge advantage. And, you end up just going to them more often. Now, no one can guarantee that every site will load equally, but at least trying to have a network that's more or less equal is a fantastic thing. And living in China made me realize what the other side looks like.
The battle here, one of the arguments by the people that say to network neutrality and the entire issue is a red herring. They say, well, when you're comparing us to China, you're comparing the situation to another country, of course, we're not going to block content access. We're not going to really slow things down. These are scare tactics. These are tactics to try to create an issue which really isn't one that anyone who's using the internet is really going to notice. But it seems like your experience in China, while not comparing AT&T and the carriers to the Chinese government, the larger issue is the issue of unfettered access to material and the ability for the network to be what many people just call stupid. It just passes information without making a value judgment as to what's important. How critical do you think, and I know you've testified in front of Congress on the issue, but maybe you could talk a little bit about that in the context of control. At what stage of critical mass are we on the network neutrality debate? Basically my question boils down to at how far along are we in the issue of network neutrality where we're really facing the real and likely possibility that information that's passed through the internet is going to be subject to these value judgments as to what's more or less important. What's your assessment of that today?
Well, I think in some ways the network neutrality movement, which is what we're talking about, has been successful in kind of scaring off some of the initial efforts to try and block or degrade service on the internet. That is to say, in the early 2000s, when cable and Bell started to become more dominant in this area, their first move was to try. I mean, it makes perfect sense for them to try and discriminate. They tried to block VPN services because they have their own VPN services. Why would you want to let someone else have another VPN service? They tried it early days to try and limit Wi-Fi usage to say, well, you know, you have to use our Wi-Fi, or, you know, you have to call us for customers. You have to have someone come over and install the Wi-Fi, you know, whatever. They were just trying to see if they could milk that for some extra money.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes perfect sense. I can understand why they do that. It just happens to be bad for the country. So, but to answer your question, I think that we've, you know, so far the network neutrality movement has struck a chord and I think has been successful in fending off some of the worst behavior. Nonetheless, I, you know, there's obviously companies wanted to do it. Some of them did it. They got scared off. And now they have sort of more middle plans, which is the same as tiered service plans, to try and sort of give preferential access to some over others. Those can also ultimately, if they're, you know, used wrongly, just replicate the same thing and end up really changing the way the internet is. And I can talk more about that. I'm not sure if we want to go on.
Well, we have.
On, but never
no,
talk.
No. I mean, it's, yeah. You know, I've run into this repeatedly on the show, which is to say that an hour just isn't enough to delve into all
right.
of these issues. And so you will be perhaps the earliest guest I have to say I'm inviting you back if you'd like to come on, although I'm not ending the discussion just yet. But we only have a few minutes left, so I do want to kind of get to the ultimate question, which is, 10 years from now, who controls right. the internet?
Yeah, well, I hope that people are conscious enough of these issues so that their governments, I think governments will play a more and more of a role, but hopefully governments in an ideal world will reflect what people want, right? And government will, in fact, protect. I mean, I think in network neutrality, for example, government has a role in protecting the internet from forces that would change it. And so I hope that, you know, I think governments, one of the theses of the book is that this whole idea of democracy and representative government, it's actually not that easy to improve upon. You mm-hmm. can get lucky and you can choose the right guy on the beach who makes the right decision, if
right.
you're lucky.
Right, right.
You can get lucky.
Right.
But it's actually pretty hard to improve upon this idea that people vote and their government officials represent themselves. There's a lot of problems with governments and elected governments. There's a lot of problems with democracy, especially, you know, some of the, you know, the way Congress is these days.
Right.
But
right.
it's really hard to improve upon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the internet, they thought they could get lucky because there was a couple of wise gurus and guys who did the right thing. But over the long term, I'm not sure that works. And so what I hope for is that, you know, people feel and understand enough about these issues that they become democratic preferences and that you have good government. You know, the American government hasn't been that bad on, I mean, the Bush administration's lately started mm-hmm. to get a little nasty. But, you know, the Clinton administration was fine on these issues. You know, indeed, even in some ways, you know, people disagree a little. But they weren't bad. And I think that our hope, our really only hope, is the same hope we've ever had, is to try and steer this line between complete anarchy and complete tyranny. And that the best line is through representative government. So that's what I hope. I hope that we have a future where, you know, the internet is mostly left on its own, and the abuses are corrected by representative government. So
you know,
that.
No, I think, that's a pretty optimistic vision for where we're going. Certainly, I've interviewed others that have a darker view of where we're headed on particular issues. But I think I share your hope, and I think you know your book, in a really remarkable way, challenges a lot of the assumptions and almost the safety that people think they might have on the internet. You challenge what, in fact, on page 51 of your book, you challenge one of the almost, you know, the catchphrases of the entire internet and technology movement and people that are focused on this stuff. John Perry Barlow's famous quote that information wants to be free. And you point out accurately that information doesn't, in fact, want to be free. It wants to be labeled, organized, and filtered. This is, I'm quoting you,
right.
So that it can be, you probably knew that, but for everyone else, I'd hate to take words out of your mouth and right here. It wants to be labeled, organized, and filtered so it can be discovered, cross-referenced, and consumed.
Right.
And the information wants to be free idea is the ideal, which I think is, and your book points out, is the one that's being challenged the most. At the end of the day, we're not dealing with the situation where individual or governmental or group interests are not playing a major role. And you've pointed out, we've discussed some of them today, and you point out
right.
more in your book. So at the end of the day, I share your hope. And I think that your experience just in the last year talking about these issues, and I should say to listeners that I met Tim when he was visiting here at Stanford, I guess last fall, if I'm correct.
Right.
I've heard you and others speak about these issues, and I think more and more people are understanding them. So I guess my last question before, unfortunately, we have to end the conversation is, so far, can you get a sense of reaction to your book? In terms of policymakers and people that are thinking about these issues?
Yeah, you know, I think it's, I think that everyone enjoys reading the book. Some people resist our conclusions. They don't, I think people, you know, don't like the idea that government, you know, the government is going to have a rising role, and you know, they just don't like government. And, you know, funny thing is, Jack and I aren't necessarily the biggest fans of government either. We just, I guess, feel that it's inevitable, and if it's going to be that way, you better work with it as opposed to against it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's too skeptical. I mean, I think it's useful to have that kind of libertarianism out there. I just think that it can lead you just to this kind of, you know, nothing can ever go wrong kind of mentality.
Right.
So, you know, so that's some of the negative reaction we've had. You know, the positive reaction is, well, my mother really liked it.
That's always a good start.
No, I mean, the most gratifying thing to me is one of the things I wanted to do in this book is I wanted to make it readable. And I think a lot of people have said, you know, they've read right through it in a couple of readings, and that's been very, just as a writer, and now we're not talking as an academic, but as a writer, to write something that people can, you know, sit there and read in front of their fire without wanting to get up every 2 minutes.
Well, that,
know,
that
is satisfying. So,
exactly, yeah. And I think is probably the best thing about the book, which is that, you know, and I think you've done it again today, taking what could be very, very complex issues and summarizing them in ways that people that are not immersed in the world understand. So I commend anyone to purchase Who Controls the Internet, Illusions of a Borderless World, authored by Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu, Tim being our guest today from Oxford Press, to anyone. Tim, thank you for being here today. I think it's been a great conversation. Is there, for people that want to learn more about you or about the book or any of these issues, do you have any recommendations or any websites that you want to mention?
You can go to my website. It mostly just says photographs of
right.
my work. If you're interested in network neutrality, I have a good page on my website which is meant to explain network neutrality. So if you just Google Tim Wu, there I am.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Tim, thank you so much for being here today. The Beastie Boys there on Remote Control, which again touches on the issues of what we're dealing with today in a very different way than some of the other songs I've played, but the issue of being able to control your environment and being able to be involved with how the world that is created it fits your value system. Tim's book, Who Controls the Internet, Illusions of a Borderless World, really touches on that stuff and really touches on the larger issue of challenging many of the assumptions that people bring to the table when they think about the Internet. It certainly challenged some of mine, and I can't advocate the book more than I have, so I'll stop advocating the book and simply say you should go out and get it. This is Dave Levine. You've been listening to Hearsay Culture, a show on KZSU-FM. You'll find me Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Going through September, and I have some great guests coming up, including Chris Hufnagel, who's now with Berkeley, previously with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, as well as Chris Sprigman, a professor of law at the University of Virginia, and someone who previously was a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society. And many other people are coming on their way, so I'm looking forward to doing more good interviews and hopefully educating those of you who aren't too familiar on these issues regarding the issues. And for those of you who are familiar with them, I hope that you find these conversations enlightening and hopefully touching on things that you hadn't thought about or hearing points that you'd want to reconsider. So I look forward to talking to you again next week. This show, again, is being recorded on August 25th and will be aired. It's probably going to be aired about a week and a half from now, so in early September. So at that point, we will be on the interim schedule here at KZSU, meaning that all I can say to you, because I don't know right now who is going to be on the air after me, is to say and ask you to keep listening to KZSU and all of the great music programming that happens here. So again, my name is Dave Levine. You've been listening to Hearsay Culture. I hope you found the show enlightening and interesting. I welcome you to and commend you and ask you to send me any comments or feedback or suggestions for future guests, and you can email me at dlevine@law.stanford.edu. Again, that's dlevine@law.stanford.edu. Or you can, of course, always check the website for the Center for Internet and Society, which is found at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Now that the academic year has started up again, you will find that we have many speakers who come and speak at Stanford, and I encourage anyone that wants to come and hear those speakers to simply check the website for the dates and times and visit the school. You can also hear my show and any speakers that happen at sponsored by CIS at the law school by checking out the podcast page that CIS maintains on iTunes. And iTunes will be a good place to find all talks and audio regarding CIS. I am still in the process, and I imagine I will still be in the process in early September, of setting up my webpage regarding the show. And so please be patient, and it will be out there soon. Thanks again to Tim. Thanks again for listening. And I'll look forward to talking to you next week.